From 89.7 WUWM Milwaukee Public Radio, this is Lake Effect. I'm Bonnie North.
And I'm Mitch Teich. Today on the show, a look at the ACLU's nationwide push to strengthen its political influence.
Later, we'll have the debut of a new monthly series on success and struggle in entrepreneurship. It's called How Did You Do That?
Until 1998, I bought a birthday present for every employee and their wives and their children, and I spent most weekends shopping. And I walked into the company one day and I realized this company was getting so big I didn't know everybody anymore.
And the roller coaster ride that is the rep's new production of Holmes and Watson just keeps accelerating.
That is what made it necessary for us to really negotiate and navigate, okay, where are these turns and how sharp are they? And how do we articulate them for an audience who may be seeing this for the first time because it's so new?
Lake Effect is next. News is first.
This is Lake Effect from 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee Public Radio. Thanks for joining us. I'm Mitch Teich.
And I'm Bonnie North. When Faz Shakir joined the ACLU this past January, the organization was still preparing for the inauguration of Donald Trump. Months prior to Shakir's arrival, the ACLU released a letter addressed to Trump threatening to sue him if he acted on several of his campaign promises.
He did, and they did. Since his first week in office, the ACLU has been fighting the Trump administration in court. But in conjunction with these legal battles, the ACLU has been working to build up its political arm in Washington and around the country.
And that's where Shakir comes in. He's the national political director for the ACLU. He was in Milwaukee recently to deliver a speech at the ACLU of Wisconsin's Bill of Rights celebration. He joined Lake Effect's Joy Powers to talk about his work and the ACLU's position as a political institution.
The ACLU is a 97-year-old legal institution that has been known for filing wonderful cases throughout its history for gender equality and racial equality, marriage equality. But increasingly, since the election of Trump, we feel a need to build up our political muscle because we can't always count on the courts to deliver the most important victories. And quite frankly, at this time, as you look around the country, some of our strength is not in Congress, it's not in the presidency, it's not in state legislatures, it's not in governorships. And you think about how the ACLU, with its mission of trying to change hearts and minds around civil rights and civil liberties in America, can do its job. The political director's job has meant mobilizing our power, and our power is generally with people. It's with activists all across the country who are eager and fired up for a new direction for our country. They see an assault on civil rights and civil liberties like never before in their lifetimes, and they want to do something about it. And so coming in as a new political director in January of this year, I felt like it was really critical that the ACLU needs to build a grassroots mobilization program. It needs to be more communicative with lay people on the street to give activists an opportunity to engage in these fights, to do something, to affiliate with the ACLU to accomplish our mission.
Is the ACLU political?
Yes, the ACLU is a political organization, for sure. It is not a partisan organization. I would make a distinction between those two. Partisan, of course, it means that you're advocating for the election or defeat of a particular candidate by virtue of their identification with the Democratic Party, Republican Party, or any other party. But we're a political organization that advocates for policy change. That's what I call a political advocacy organization, someone who is looking to change surveillance laws in our country, the laws that govern reproductive health, the laws that govern LGBT equality. Those are things that we care deeply about. We fight for them in the courts, but we also fight for them in state legislatures. And because we do that, you know, I think it's incumbent upon us to utilize every tool at our disposal. So as I was saying, it's not just litigating in courts. It's not just calling up a few state lawmakers and saying, hey, can you do this wonderful thing? It's got to be broader than that, particularly at this day and age when the threats are so grave and we seem to be constantly playing on defense on many of these issues. So we've got to mobilize the public, and that has been at the forefront of every thought of building up a new political program at the ACLU.
When we say mobilize the public, I feel like we hear these kinds of terms a lot, but they end up being these sort of amorphous terms for what?
Yeah.
What does mobilizing the public actually look like?
It's a great question, and I think of it as in two buckets. There's one that's just the Women's March style mobilization, like get out, get your voices heard. Or what we did during the Affordable Care Act, call your member of Congress, just pick up the phone and do something. When we were building our political program, we wanted to join in all of those things, but we really had a different model of what we thought mobilization should be. Our program is called People Power. You can access it at peoplepower.org. We built it on a creed and a belief. We wanted to give people a meaningful action that they could take in their community to accomplish policy change. Let me give you a specific example of what we said. So we're like, okay, I want to empower volunteer activists to be pseudo staff of the ACLU to accomplish things that we as ACLU staff alone could not do. And so one of the first things we said is let's mobilize to protect immigrants all across the nation from Trump's mass deportation agenda. And let's try to build freedom cities, what we call freedom cities, and change some of the laws in our cities that pertain to how cops can ask you about your status and how long they can keep you in jail and what they can pull you into jail for. And we mobilized all across the country asking volunteer activists to advocate for a set of model rules and ordinances pertaining to immigration laws. Sanctuary city type laws. And we said, you know, we can't do this ourselves. So we're turning the ball over to you. We would appreciate if you could go meet with your local sheriff, your local law enforcement, your mayor, your city council, and see if they'd be willing to adopt these welcoming ordinances. And oh my God, it's amazing. When you ask people to step up and you treat them with respect and you give them a high bar, an ambitious goal, they take to it. So all across the country, we've seen Ann Arbor, Michigan, take this up and pass it. Dane County here, Madison, passed it. Phoenix, Arizona, Middlesex County, New Jersey, Berwyn, Illinois, Rockville, Maryland, Silver City, New Mexico, all across the country. They shock you and surprise you because they took it upon themselves to advocate for the policy change that they wanted to see with just a little guidance from the ACLU.
One of the things you just mentioned is kind of the fight against a lot of the proposals from the Trump administration. So even before Trump gets into office, the ACLU had already built out a plan of how to combat some of the things he was proposing. They accused him of essentially going against the Constitution. After his election, the head of the ACLU sends him a letter, you know, citing which amendments he would be going against. What's happened since then? You know, there were all these plans to do all of these different things. What's happened?
Oh, man. It's been a whirlwind. It's been a whirlwind. So flashing back to the middle of last year, we're in the middle of like the DNC convention, the Republican convention, and most people check me on this, but most people were like, oh, you know, Hillary's on the path to winning. And so here, Anthony Romero, the executive director of the ACLU, is urging the entire institution to do a documentation of Trump's policy positions and identify where his policies might be in contravention of the Constitution. And he's asking his staff to do that. And most of the people are like, why? Like, don't you know Hillary's going to win? And so we produce the Trump memos. And it provided the guide map for the possibility that Trump might win. And guess what? He did. And it positioned the ACLU, I think, to have an approach right out of the box. And as you suggested and mentioned, on the day after he was elected, we wrote a letter in the New York Times, took out a full-page ad, and said, we'll see you in court. If you pursue all of the unconstitutional threats and pledges that you've made during the course of the campaign, we documented them all across the board. If you pursue these, then we're going to challenge you in court. And we have done that. So 1 week in to the administration, right? He's inaugurated on January 20th. 1 week in, January 27th, he issues the Muslim ban. And within hours, we're in a Brooklyn courtroom and successfully win a lawsuit there. Almost every court across America after that ruled against him, not only on the Muslim ban 1.0, but then 2.0. We're still stuck in a legal morass over that as he tries to pursue a discriminatory law. So it wasn't just the Muslim ban. We've been so busy on so many immigration matters. I mean, just recently, I've seen the Trump administration, try to detain a woman and prevent her from having an abortion. And that was her constitutional right. We argued it, and we won that case. The case was called Jane Doe because we didn't want her identity made public. But that was another, you know, an intersectional issue, an immigration issue and a reproductive health issue joined together. We just saw another one. Rosa, a young girl at the border who was detained because she was having gallbladder surgery and was separated from her family. We advocated and fought for her release and got that. So we've won that one, too. Trump issued a ban on transgender persons from serving in the military. We're fighting that one in court and we're winning in court. We're busy. There's a lot of work to do. But I guess I take heart from the past 10, 11 months that the resistance is working, the rule of law is working, the courts are serving as a good check on the excesses of President Trump. So I generally feel positive and good about the direction that we're going, and now we see the American public starting to vote for a change in direction as well.
Now, you're actually the son of immigrants from Pakistan. Yeah. How personal are these battles for you?
You know, I was raised Muslim. I have a funny name. I'm a brown-skinned person. And there are days when I wake up and I hear the things that Trump says. I'm like, man, this guy thinks I am the enemy. He thinks, like, essentially, I need to be kicked out of this country or I need to be surveilled. I need to that I am a threat. And it doesn't feel good. But the fact that there are so many people who affiliate and sound support for this perspective is heartwarming. I mean, you remember, I was just referring to the Muslim ban. The story of the Muslim ban was that thousands upon thousands of non-Muslims rushed into airports to defend their Muslim brothers and sisters, their neighbors. And seeing the reaction from such a broad swath of the American public said, hell no, like this is not what we stand for. That makes it all much, much better.
The ACLU has taken a lot of heat for their representation of white supremacists. Most recently, there's a situation going on with Taylor Swift, whose lawyers sent a letter to a conservative blogger who essentially said that she was involved with white supremacy. Why does the ACLU continue to represent and defend white supremacists?
Because we believe in free speech for everybody. If you really believe in free speech for all, you're going to be tested in that belief by others who are going to pick the least popular group and push that group onto you and say, hey, you want free speech for that person? And if you allow for the encroachment upon speech restrictions for, let's say, white supremacists, you know who's coming next? It's going to be Black Lives Matter. It's going to be Greenpeace activists. It's going to be abortion protesters, abortion rights protesters. It's going to be pro-Palestinian protesters, right? All of these folks, marginalized or unpopular groups, people who have a thought that is considered on the fringe, they're going to be penalized and criminally punished for a point of view. That's something we are vigilantly on guard about. So we've defended in Charlottesville and in so many places the right of people with whom we disagree vehemently on racial justice matters, the right to speak. You know, as a political director, I'm not launching these lawsuits, but I am trying to mobilize the public around what we're trying to accomplish. And I think it's important that, you know, we're an organization that believes in more speech. Let's have more speech. And the best way that you can reject speech that you hate is by not showing up. I mean, imagine if an Ann Coulter or a Milo or Steve Bannon shows up to a college campus and has to speak to a room of 10 people. That's embarrassing. That's sad for them. And that's the way it should be. And I think oftentimes the effort to try to repress their speech only gets them more attention and gives them the satisfaction that they're looking for. So I think that from our perspective, we're trying to mobilize people in the instances where we end up representing somebody whose values we abhor. We're going to continue at the ACLU to mobilize the public in contravention to that person's ideas. So we'll represent a white supremacist in court, but we will simultaneously be mobilizing public to attend rallies or protests in defiance of the views of that person. We're going to live our values. We're going to live the fact that we believe in more speech, and we're going to promote more speech.
What is the ACLU's view on hate speech? Because I think that's where a lot of people get caught up. You mentioned Black Lives Matter, mm-hmm. Greenpeace, and these organizations, yes, say things that a lot of people don't maybe agree with, but rarely do they engage in hate speech, in speech that encourages violence, unlike many of these white supremacist groups.
You use the key word there, violence. And that's where we draw a line. If you're coming to instigate violence, that's not speech. That's actually repressing speech. That's intimidating, right? That it's going to stop people from exercising their First Amendment right. And I think Charlottesville certainly caused our organization to become clear about that. And I think the challenge with Charlottesville is when we represented the client there, he testified that he would not be engaging in a violent protest. Of course, we saw what ended up happening. And so should we and others who represent groups like that be more discerning or critical of the pledges that they make to us as our clients? Right. So they say, hey, no, we're not going to bring guns to this march. We're not going to engage in any violence. We need to probably engage in a much stronger effort to check that pledge that they're making to us and to critique it, to assess whether we think that's valid and whether they're going to hold to that. So that is one takeaway from Charlottesville, is that we probably got to be much more discerning about challenging the claims that people make to us. Secondly, when people are bringing arms to a protest, we've been clear that we're not going to represent you. When you bring guns, it too often is going to repress speech. It's going to intimidate others from not showing up, from being able to voice their opinion. And that's not a road that we want to go down.
All right. Well, Faz, thank you so much for joining us here on Lake Effect and speaking with me today.
Thank you. Appreciate the opportunity.
Faz Shakir is the National Political Director for the ACLU. He was in Milwaukee to deliver a speech at the ACLU of Wisconsin's Bill of Rights celebration. There's more information at WUWM.com.
Coming up after a break, we'll check in with WUWM's Annalise Hensel about the latest news coming from Lincoln Hills, Wisconsin's youth prison. Lake Effect continues in a moment on Milwaukee Public Radio.
More of Lake Effect on Milwaukee Public Radio. I'm Mitch Teich.
And I'm Bonnie North. Problems at the state's troubled youth prison, Lincoln Hills, continue to come to light. Over the past 2 years, we've learned about numerous complaints regarding how the inmates are treated. At the same time, reports have surfaced about teens attacking guards. A federal probe of the facility continues.
Just last week, the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel reported that women who work at Lincoln Hills say they've been taunted and sexually harassed by some of the inmates. Patrick Marley has been covering the story for the paper. He told WUWM's Annalise Hensel about this latest report.
This is sort of a new type of issue that we're bringing to light here, but there's obviously a great number of problems and challenges for Lincoln Hills. It's been under criminal investigation for almost 3 years now. It's subject to multiple lawsuits, including a class action lawsuit that's resulted in various changes to the way that the institution has to operate. They can't use pepper spray as much. They can't use solitary confinement as much. In the last few months, we've heard a lot more disruptions from inmates. So the people who run the place definitely have their hands full.
And a couple of Republican lawmakers who represent the area where Lincoln Hills is located have said that they want the judge to, I guess, walk back that order. They want the staff to be able to have the opportunity to use those more severe methods of controlling inmates.
That's right. The two Republican lawmakers up there have said that. The judge wrote them a letter back saying that he appreciated their comments, but they should direct those to the Department of Corrections because they're not parties to the lawsuit. Notably, the Department of Corrections recently responded in court filings to the incidents and say they have some concerns about recent disruptions, but that they are not asking the judge to change the order that he's put in place, limiting the use of solitary confinement and pepper spray. The department says they're going to try to do some other things, possibly including sending the most aggressive inmates off to another facility for more intensive treatment.
As your story was being published on Thursday, there were a number of advocates who were calling for changes at Lincoln Hills. They want to close the facility. They also want Milwaukee County to take a more active role in bringing some of the county's inmates back here. Do you have any sense of how far along any efforts that would represent really big change like that might be?
So the Department of Corrections has maintained that it's made significant changes since all of these problems came to light, including putting body cameras on all their staff, giving staff a week's more training than they had had in the past. The advocates for the inmates say that it's not enough. Regarding attempts to close the facility and move to a regional model where you keep more inmates in Milwaukee County or wherever the inmates would come from, that seems not to have gained traction with the legislature. The governor doesn't seem to want to go that route. You would need a law change to do that. Although those voices are increasingly making that argument, you're not really seeing that catch momentum in the current political environment in Madison.
While you're continuing to learn more about what's going on within the facility, the big investigation itself remains underway. So the story is still developing. We're not at the end of this.
Oh, clearly we're not at the end of it. I mean, I think we'll be hearing more about this in the coming months or longer. You know, this litigation is going to continue. This investigation will end at some point. Whether that results in charges or not, we don't know. But that's still ongoing. And it does seem that, you know, every week or two we learn about some new aspect of Lincoln Hills we didn't know about, such as all the sexual harassment that women workers face there from inmates.
Do you have a sense that the investigation is moving as quickly as possible and that changes are being put into place as quickly as possible? I know that these are really unwieldy things to do, and I'm sure that the advocates are saying, hey, it's all moving way too slowly. But covering this closely, what sense do you get of how things are moving along?
So it's really hard to get a good handle on what's happening with the criminal investigation. It's been going on for 3 years. The first year it was run by our Attorney General, Brad Schimel, and then it got turned over to the FBI. They don't show their cards much as to what they're doing with it, how quickly they're moving. They say it's a complex case, and complex cases take a long time. I think some critics say they're concerned that they're not taking it as seriously as they should and not prioritizing it enough. I just don't have a good sense of where that's at. As to the speed of which changes are being made at Lincoln Hills, that's really being steered at this point by the class action lawsuit. Very significant changes were forced out of the institution from the July injunction. Those are still sort of unfolding. Prison leaders have said they have not been able to fully comply with the injunction because of some disruptions, but the ACLU that's brought that lawsuit is going to be continuing to say to the judge, they've got to make these changes, and if they don't, then they're going to have to close the facility. That is going to make the state trying to get the place in a condition that the judge can sign off on, because it would be very expensive to close a facility and move these inmates elsewhere.
Patrick Marley is a reporter for the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel. He talked with WUWM's Annalise Henzel about the latest problems coming to light at the state's troubled youth prison, Lincoln Hills.
Another quick break, and then we'll premiere a new monthly series on entrepreneurship right here on Lake Effect from WUWM. This is Lake Effect on Milwaukee Public Radio. Welcome back. I'm Mitch Tite.
And I'm Bonnie North. Today, we debut a new monthly series on entrepreneurship.
Hi, I'm Kathleen Gallagher.
Kathleen Gallagher is the new executive director of the Milwaukee Institute here in town. And I'm Tim Keene.
Tim is founder and director of Golden Angels Investors. And this is How Did You Do That? A show about successful entrepreneurs and how and why they succeeded. But first, we're going to get the lowdown from Tim. His story is emblematic of those we're going to tell on this show. As his story opens, it's 1984, and Tim is about to leave a good job at GE Healthcare to start a new firm with a couple of partners, a firm that specializes in retail marketing data. Tim, I have to ask, it was 1984. How did you do that? And what did your parents say when you left a well-paying corporate job?
Well, actually, they told people they thought I'd been fired because they didn't understand how anybody would leave a career at GE, where my dad had worked his whole life, to do this.
So you leapt out of this comfortable job. Your parents thought you'd been fired, but you saw an opportunity. What'd you do? How did you start leveraging that opportunity?
Well, the real magic was that I went and talked to a guy named Ed Carroll, who was the longtime senior vice president of marketing at Boston Store. And Eddie was spectacular. He understood what we were trying to do. I think he was a little bit skeptical about whether we could really pull it off, but he gave us the chance to prove it to him. And then when we did, he signed up, and away we went.
Tim's company doesn't seem revolutionary today, but in the 1980s, it was one of the first to bring data and analytics to retail marketing.
At the time, remember, the way that marketing was done in department stores was all newspaper advertising, and therefore pretty undifferentiated. We actually did some work early on that showed that there were a few very, very good customers of the downtown store, and one of them was the CEO's wife. And he didn't believe the data when he saw it the first time until we actually printed all the invoices and brought them back for him to look at. And he called his wife and said, you know, Gladys, did you really spend $42,000 in the store last year? And she said, no, dear.
So that's called get a client by proving to them their wife is spending too much?
Well, or whatever it was, right? But that really was the basis. We also set out to do something that I guess we probably were too inexperienced to know we couldn't do, which was we were telling people in 1984 that they could take all the transactions of all their customers and find people who had made a specific series of purchases, two hats and a shirt on a Tuesday in Cleveland, but no shoes since the year before. It's called an exact transaction. Today it's pretty trivial, but in 1984 it was a big deal. Really what we were doing was making offers to customers for stuff they wanted and liked at prices that were better than the normal everyday prices. And it really transformed the Boston store business in those days, made them quite successful relative to what they'd been doing before, and saved them a lot of money on advertising. I don't recall that I got a Christmas card from the Milwaukee Journal that year.
It must have been intimidating to be operating in this new area by yourself without a lot of support.
Well, I had a couple of very early partners who were terrific. There was a young man named Robert Shobin, who went to work for Steve Jobs and now lives in California. There was a guy named Dave Schneider, who's still in Milwaukee here, who was really our first big sales guy. And then a couple of data scientists who were part-timers doing the work. And I have to say, Jack Calhoun, CEO of Rexnord, was really an important partner in all of this, because Jack believed in what we were doing. At the time, they had Rexnord data systems, and he let us run our stuff multiple times. In those days, you paid for each cycle, like you paid for electricity. If we had done that, we would have gone out of business.
So, you know, that's really interesting. A lot of entrepreneurs today struggle with how do they develop relationships with corporations. How did you talk these people into letting you in the door?
Well, they had capacity they wanted to sell. I needed to buy it in a certain way to make the business come out. I gave them fundamentally a commission on the work, and they were really happy with it.
What about the technology? You know, you weren't a technology guy. How did you figure that out?
Oh, the technology, meaning the computer technology, was actually pretty simple. It was just brute force. So we'd design an inquiry, and then we would run it multiple times until we got the counts right, and that would generate a customer list, which then turned into mailing labels and wound up on catalogs.
So in the late 80s, early 90s, I don't think a lot of people knew how to use a computer.
No, and neither did I. We had the Rexnord data science guys and our own part-time programmers from, you know, in those days you could go hire a COBOL programmer on an hourly basis from one of these COBOL programming shops, and that's what we did.
You know, this really gets to something kind of fundamental about building a company. The sense I'm getting is you were the visionary leader. You had the vision, and you were finding all the people you needed to plug into the different parts.
Yeah, I guess that's probably right.
Yeah.
Sure. I mean, early on, we had a lot of people who knew a lot more about retail than I did, because we went out and found them. But the general guiding principle of using this sort of thing to help retailers get more efficient, I guess that was probably me.
You know, it always sounds so easy in retrospect, but you had to have your nights of no sleep, your moments of paralyzing fear. How did you handle that, knowing, how did you handle the risk?
Well, it depends, of course, on what stage. You know, it's really easy to say, well, you can always get another job. But the reality was that in the beginning, right, when it was really just me, I signed a big personal guarantee with the bank to get a loan, to get a couple of things to get started. And I signed a guarantee for a lot more money than I had. So it really didn't matter much because if it went away, it was all going to go away anyhow. But early on, when you're starting to have a payroll, the real sleepless nights are making that payroll every month. The reality of loss is, of course, you know, we can all find something else to do and we can all continue to eat, but you may not ever recover. And if you do have considerable net worth in a business and you lose it all, it's a tough go. It's, you know, risk and risk reward are one of those things you just have to manage to. On the other hand, Ernest Hemingway, I think, said something like, man is only composed of the risks he's willing to take.
That doesn't mean everything always ran smoothly. Tell me about, there was an episode with an airplane.
Yeah, there was. So we were printing labels for Boston store. And
this was how far into the company's life?
Oh, this is 1990, I suppose.
So a year or two.
And boy, we had great people. And we were doing three persons' work with one person. And somebody just stretched it too far. He worked 24 hours in a row to get a job out for the big annual sale. And he missed a little thing in the software. And we wound up mismailing a couple of 100,000 customers, which really meant that the best customers for that event didn't get a catalog prior to the event. And we're talking here about like Monday and the event kicks off Friday or something. So we reprinted a couple of 100,000 catalogs, relabeled them, sorted them by all the little towns that they mailed from, because remember Boston store was sort of Springfield, Illinois to Milwaukee, and I think there might have been some Indiana in there. And you couldn't mail them in Milwaukee because they'd never get there on time. So we chartered a DC-3 out of Oshkosh and because it's a freight hauler. And we set out flying from little airport to little airport, calling taxi cabs as we landed, loading up the mail and driving it over to the post office. And we got it all out and we made the sale.
And you were a young company. How did you pay for that?
I mortgaged my house.
Ah. And was Mary still with you at that
point?
Oh,
yes. Oh, yes. We earned it all back. But what really happened is from 1990 until I sold the company 10 years later, Boston store was our founding client and our best client and our best reference and would tell everybody that they talked to that they loved us. And that paid for itself 20 times over. We got real lucky. We walked up to the cash edge at least twice, made some terrible decisions about investments. I mean, in 1999, Battery Ventures wanted to fund us, and I didn't realize what that meant and turned them down. And then NCR wanted to buy us, and we passed on that. But, you know, well, it's all tuition.
in the School of Entrepreneurship, huh?
That's exactly right.
What was your ask? You know, especially early on, it sounds like you got real quality people to potentially jump over the cliff with you. You know, how'd you get them to come?
Well, don't forget, we had customers, so we had cash. So we had cash flow to pay people with. And we had equity that we shared with folks that made a big difference.
But after growing the company to the point where it employed more than 200 people, Tim sold it in a two-step transaction, first to Experian and then to Metavante for more than $20 million. It was 1999, and the dot-com bubble was deflating. Tim picks up the story.
It seemed to me that it was the time to maybe move on. The other thing that happened that I always tell people that seems trivial is until 1998, I bought a birthday present for every employee and their wives and their children, and I spent most weekends shopping. And I walked into the company one day, and the receptionist wouldn't let me go upstairs because I didn't have a pass or something. And they just hired her, and she didn't know who I was, and I had to stop and explain myself, and then I got upstairs. But I realized this company was getting so big I didn't know everybody anymore, and that's probably a weakness of mine because obviously, you know, that's just the way growth happens. So we decided to sell.
Since 2002, Tim has run Golden Angels Investors, one of the biggest angel investing networks in the state. Its members put money into promising startup companies.
Well, there are about 100 investors and about 50 Golden Angels advisors, which is our new younger generation group that's growing like crazy.
And you've got an incubator. You've got space for
startups. We've got some space.
Out in Brookfield. You're in Bishop's Woods, right?
Right.
What kind of advice are you giving, especially those younger investor wannabes and these companies you're investing in? What are some of the things you focus on most?
Customers first. Now, 99% of the time, we do have a pharmaceutical company that we really love that I don't think we'll ever see a dollar of revenue from because that's just not the business that they're in. But aside from that, customers are everything. Getting people to use your product and talk about it and understanding what they want and getting that right rapidly and iterating, that's 90% of it. We talk about customer acquisition cost all the time, not so much as a financial measurement as a tool to help you see how you need to do things to get the opportunity to happen, right? I mean, finance is often that way. It's really sort of a feedback loop rather than an end in itself.
Well, Tim, the experience you bring to this is amazing. Thanks for sharing the story of how you did it. You can read more about Tim Keen's story and suggest ideas for future episodes of How Did You Do That by visiting us at wuwm.com.
How Did You Do That is produced by WUWM in association with the Milwaukee Institute and Golden Angels Investors.
We'll take one last break and then catch up with two of the stars of the Milwaukee Rep's new production of Holmes and Watson, a conversation with actors Norman Moses and Mark Corkins when Lake Effect continues on WUWM.
Lake Effect continues now on Milwaukee Public Radio. I'm Mitch Teich.
And I'm Bonnie North. This past weekend saw the opening of Holmes and Watson at the Milwaukee Rep. This production is the Midwest premiere of the play and is directed by the Rep's former artistic director, Joe Hanready.
It stars Norman Moses and Mark Corkins, two men very familiar to Milwaukee theater audiences. Between them, they have more than 60 years of onstage experience, and in this play, they get to show off all of that skill and experience to great theatrical effect.
I met with Corkins and Moses a couple of weeks ago just before a rehearsal, and they obliged by offering us this tidbit from Holmes and Watson.
So, is the great detective here among us?
Well, they are rather similar.
That has been the challenge.
Of course, it has been 3 years, and none of these men appear to be at his physical best.
I hope you're not saying you don't recognize him. If you can't identify Mr. Holmes, I haven't a clue where we'll turn. His brother Mycroft is reported to be on a mission of great sensitivity and cannot be reached. Your former landlady, Mrs. Hudson, is visiting her sister somewhere in the wilds of Wales. There aren't even any photographs of Mr. Holmes to make comparisons.
Yes, I fear Holmes was notorious for not allowing his picture to be taken. Perhaps the patients might, speak?
To you?
Yes.
What would you propose be the subject of your exchange?
His return to life. How he survived the falls at Reichenbach.
Reichenbach.
You are acquainted with the incident.
Not comprehensively. I know it was reported on at the time.
The particulars were extremely condensed. My own was the fullest account.
I'm afraid I haven't read it. I don't care much for fiction.
My stories are not fiction.
They are stories, though. They appear alongside fiction in the popular press?
Guilt by association?
Surely you don't claim they have the same veracity as news items?
I take great pains in my writing to represent the incidents as accurately as possible.
I'm sorry, But accounts written long after the events they purport to portray, combined with the demands of the market to satisfy the public taste, do suggest a certain, shall we say, imprecision.
What do you know of the case?
Just that Mr. Holmes died following an altercation with a retired teacher?
Professor Moriarty was the Napoleon of crime.
Delusions of grandeur there.
Gentlemen, it is so great to see you both again. Thank you for that reading.
Oh, you're very welcome.
Oh, yeah. Thank you.
Good to see you, Bonnie.
This must be fun.
We are having a great time. It is such a great group of artists, and the play is such a challenge and so much fun. We laugh a lot. It's great. Yeah.
Yeah, and you get to do voices. Accents.
We do. Actually, Claire Hayden, our dialect coach, was the person who first thought, hey, what if Dr. Evans was a Scot? And it made sense. Takes place in Scotland, off the coast of Starkhaven.
So, without giving anything away, Norman, can you give me an idea of the premise of the play?
Well, if you were read any of the Sherlock Holmes canon, there is one of the stories, The Final Problem. And people may know this from the Sherlock Holmes movie with Robert Downey Jr. It's when Professor Moriarty and Sherlock Holmes have a final struggle at the Falls of Reichenbach, which is a very high falls, and they both fall over the edge of the falls and are both presumed dead. And it is a period of about 3 years, and then eventually Sherlock Holmes does resurface. And this kind of takes place in between The Final Problem, which is the last one of one series of his books, and the beginning of the next series, which is, I think, the Empty House is where Holmes makes his return. So our play kind of takes place sort of not quite in between. It's not based on any real story. He's taken information from the stories and created his own premise. And Watson has been called upon to identify people claiming to be Sherlock Holmes over the past several years.
So he hasn't resurfaced yet.
He hasn't resurfaced in this in our version. So Watson is sort of the debunker. He goes and he gets this mysterious message, a telegram saying that there are three people claiming to be Sherlock Holmes on an island, in an asylum, in the middle of nowhere in Scotland, and it takes him
in
about
in the winter too, right?
Very exclusive.
Very exclusive.
Yeah. Yes, and somewhat remote, isolated, one might say.
Yes. So there are ferries involved.
Ferries and skiffs and shallops. Yes. All these these great boats.
Police cutters.
Yeah, a lot of boats. I didn't even think of that.
And Mark, you are Dr. Evans, who is sort of in charge of this.
Yes, I'm a psychiatrist, and I'm the, shall we say, chief medical officer of this rather exclusive asylum, and I'm the one who admits in a very short span of time three individuals, all of whom certainly fit the physical description of Sherlock Holmes, but they're all claiming in one way or another to be the late great detective. And as you heard in the scene, we've reached out to Holmes' brother and his former landlady, and we've sent a telegram to Dr. Watson in London to see if he'd be willing to come out and interview the gang.
Yes, because Dr. Watson would know.
He would know. He would know. Which is the real Sherlock Holmes, even though it's been a few years and Holmes is notorious for disguises. But that's the idea, is that he would instantaneously know who he was. But things are not always are not what they seem to be at the asylum. So Watson kind of goes on the defensive a little bit to try to figure out
what's really happening.
What's really happening?
Well, in the layers that are written, that Jeffrey Hatcher has written into this, are delicious. I mean, there's so much that you think you figured it out, and you haven't. And again, without giving anything away, was it fun for you when you sat down with the whole cast to actually work your way through the actual script to the end?
Yes. Joe Hanratty, our director, has assembled a cast of not only very talented actors, but really smart, curious people. And we ran into, during our several table days over the table, looking at the script, lots of places where, hey, wait a minute, wait, how does this connect? And then we all put our heads together, and we think we found. we were just aware of the fact that there will be Holmesians out there. There's going to be fans who are very familiar with the canon. And what are we going to say at talkbacks when people who really know the material ask us, hey, what about? And I think we've done pretty well.
We have, and it's been a real process. The play is so layered, as you say, that every day you'd go home and you start thinking about stuff. You think you'd found a hole in the script. Oh, Jeffrey's, slipped up here. This doesn't make sense. This couldn't have happened in this situation. Then you go home and you start thinking about it, and all of it kind of, you start piecing things that you've heard in the play, and it's like, oh, God, how stupid am I that I didn't put that together? Oh, of course, that makes perfect sense. And it's just been a process of every day. It's sort of like a new revelation, and you bring that in, you're sharing those ideas, and it's like, oh, no, it's not really quite what we thought it was. It really is more this, and it's just much more interesting and intriguing that way. So it's been a real challenge, and like Mark says, it's got a room full of really bright people who just are sort of relentless in their in their dedication.
That's what you want, relentless actors.
Yeah. And Joe is a very, very smart director, and all of us putting our heads together, the hive mind of, I think, as Mark said, I think we have figured it out. There are a couple of moments still that I am not quite 100% sure about, but I think that kind of makes it fun a little bit. It's a sort of an unknown moment in the play that even we as the characters are not quite sure what's going on with each other, and
Yeah, the other thing that is somewhat unique about this play is, we started doing run-throughs here in the rehearsal hall maybe a week ago, and we were coming in under 80 minutes, right, and knowing that once we add all of the technical elements that will flesh out, and then of course, a theater full of people will also add a little time. But it's amazing that it's like getting on a ride, and it just keeps accelerating. there's a few little slower moments, memory sequences. But it's really exhilarating, and that is what made it necessary for us to really negotiate, navigate, okay, where are these turns, and how sharp are they, and how do we articulate them for an audience who may be obviously seeing this for the first time because it's so new, but also maybe people who the only thing they know about Sherlock Holmes is the pipe and the deerstalker hat. Maybe they've never read or seen a film, so... it has been really exhilarating.
I'm just sitting here listening to you two. When was the last time you were in a show together, besides the Door County?
I was doing a little research this morning on my computer. I keep my database of all the shows I've done. And Mark, the last time we worked together on the Powerhouse stage here at the Rep was in 1988. Well, it would have been 1989, but it was when his daughter, Molly, was born, and several months after that, my daughter, Kelsey, was born. We were doing Precious Memories.
Yes.
When Molly was born, I looked that up.
Yes.
Played by Romulus Linney, directed by John Dillon. This was during the John Dillon era.
Wow.
And then we were doing She Stoops to Conquer. When
Ken Albers directed that.
That's when my daughter was born, and our understudies had to go on for us.
That's right. It's been a while.
It's 20 years. Yeah, it's as old as our children are.
I was going to say almost 30 years.
Yeah, almost 30 years. Yeah.
That's amazing. Because I was thinking, I've interviewed you both for different shows over the years since I've been here, and I've been here almost 12 years, and I thought, they've never been in a show together that I've talked to you about. And so that I was trying to think. And so, no, I wasn't around the last time you were on the Powerhouse stage together.
We did do the Scottish play with Milwaukee Shakespeare.
Yes, and I think that was the last time. And that was what, 2007?
Seven sounds right.
Yeah. So 10 years ago. Yes.
Well, I don't know. It feels like our lives are much more intertwined than maybe that resume of shared. Yeah, yeah, it's interesting.
And here we are back in Scotland.
Scotland, yes. Right.
Different part of Scotland, I think, but in a different era. But anyway, mm-hmm. It must feel good to be back on stage again.
It is. It's been 30 years since I've been on the Powerhouse. You know, that was the last time we worked together, and that was the last time I did a show there. So I'm very excited to get back. It was interesting walking the halls and... Well, that's one of the things I really felt is just, boy, how many shows have taken place in that theater in the last 30 years. And, you know, I don't know. It's putting on a play is a real, it consumes your life, you know, and you think of all the times that has happened and, you know, in that space. It's kind of special.
And you're carrying it on with this one.
We are.
There's some amazing language in this one.
Sure is. And Joe is quite, he's very demanding in terms of the specificity and being spot on in terms of the saying all the words in the right order, which you may take for granted, but there's really, as Joe said, there's very little margin for error. That it really is a dance between flow and great specificity, which takes a lot of repetition, a lot of going back, and as he reminded us, rehearsal is rehearing. Mm-hmm. So, and I love the fact that Joe is he's attracted to plays that demand heightened language, and then that calls for working with actors who are capable of making the delineations and kinds of adjustments that he will call for. And sometimes you'll say, wow, I didn't even think of that particular spin on a line. But it's nice to be able to make those adjustments.
Well, in a play like this, too, if you messed something up, you could give away the whole thing, and no pressure, at all. But you really could. You could mess it up.
Sure. Well, that's true of any play, but...
But particularly one that hangs so, so much on not giving things away until the proper time.
Right, right.
Yeah. I mean, all in good time is very much a part of this play, because otherwise... You just skip to the end, and you don't want to do that. Because as a reader and somebody who's going to watch this, I want to enjoy the journey of getting there.
Because
that's just so much fun. And that's, to me, it seems like it's so much fun for you to play as well.
Well, it's going to be fun for the audience to see if they can figure out.
Yes. Yeah.
And I think if they get it, it's just going to be a lucky guess.
I do too, because it's not obvious. Well, gentlemen, always great to see you both.
Always great to talk to you.
You too. And thank you so much for taking some time out of rehearsal.
We do appreciate you coming in to join us.
Yeah, absolutely.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Mark Corkins and Norman Moses star in the Midwest premiere of Jeffrey Hatcher's Holmes and Watson. It opened this past weekend at the Milwaukee Rep and runs through mid-December. There's more information at WUWM.com. That's today's edition of the show. I'm Mitch Teich.
And I'm Bonnie North. Thank you so much for tuning in today. I hope you'll be with us again tomorrow at 10 for another edition of Lake Effect here on listener-supported 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee Public Radio, NPR in Milwaukee.
Stay tuned. Fresh air is next.